Your Excellency David Hurley, Governor of New South Wales, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to Bligh Street. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Institute, and it's my pleasure to be introducing today's discussion between two very fine analysts, Dr. Jim Lindsay from the Council on Foreign Relations and our very own Anthony Bubalo. I've known Jim for more than a decade. He's someone for whom I have enormous respect. He is a reminder of a different era in American foreign policy when there were nonpartisan experts with deep knowledge of the world who were patriots, but who, to quote Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence, had a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. Jim served in the Clinton administration. He's held senior positions at the Brookings Institution, the Council on Foreign Relations, the University of Texas, and elsewhere. He's published widely on various aspects of US foreign policy and international relations and has written a number of books, including America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. In his current roles at the Council, he is the Senior Vice President, Director of Studies, and the Morris R. Greenberg Chair. So he runs all the research output at one of the most storied think tanks in the world. Anthony Bubalo, of course, is Jim's counterpart here at the Lowy Institute. Anthony, in his pre-institute days, was a very able Australian diplomat, served throughout the Middle East, an official. He was a former speechwriter to the Foreign Minister. He's one of Australia's leading experts on the Middle East, and since 2012, he's been the research director here at the Institute, responsible for coordinating our program of research. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted that for once I'm not called upon to participate, but instead I can sit in the crowd, in the audience with you and listen and learn. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. Let me hand over to Anthony Bubalo.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Michael. And Jim, it's great to welcome you to the Lowy Institute.
It's great to be here, Anthony.
So the topic today is American leadership. We could talk, not for an hour, we could talk for many days about that. And before I come to some of the parts of the world where we're looking to America for leadership, I wanted to ask that general question. You know, the world these days seems to be getting worse. Crises in the Middle East, problems in Europe, the challenge of a rising China and Asia. So the demand for American leadership is greater than ever before. But the questions about American leadership, about the strength of the American economy, about the strength of the American military, are also greater than ever before. I mean, what can the world expect from American leadership? And what, in fact, should we expect from American leadership?
An excellent question. Great place to start. But before I answer it, let me thank Michael for that very, very kind introduction. I wish my parents were here to see it. My father would have appreciated it. My mother would have believed it. You ask an excellent question, and I guess I would observe that American leadership is much like oxygen. When it's absent, you notice it. When you have too much of it, it can be explosive. And I think as we look out right now, the world is a very troubled place. It consumes, I think, a great deal of time in Washington, and all around the world, people are asking for the United States to do something. In some parts of the world, region you know quite well, the Middle East, I guess I'm skeptical on what American leadership can actually accomplish. A number of people have noted recently that in Iraq, the United States invaded and occupied and got a failure. In Libya, the United States helped an invasion and didn't occupy and got a failure. In Syria, the United States neither invaded nor occupied and got a failure. So perhaps in some parts of the world, the ability of American leadership to affect the positive outcome people want may be limited. I think in other parts of the world, people disagree greatly over what they want American leadership to do. One of the reasons I'm here on this trip is because I'm trying to get a sense of attitudes in the region toward American leadership. People talk about things like the pivot or the rebalance, if you prefer. And what I hear is people want American leadership, but they don't mean the same thing by it. They want to be reassured by the United States, but obviously the potential for when the United States asserts leadership is to make people very, very unhappy.
And what about Americans themselves, both the political class, the elites, and the American population more generally? When they look out upon the world, they see the same crises, the same turmoil that we all do. I mean, what do they think that America should, what role do they think America should be playing in the world?
Well, I think it depends upon which Americans you ask. I think, as you know, Anthony, there's been a lot of polling of the American public about how much they want the country to engage abroad. There was a spate of polls 2 or 3 years ago suggesting that Americans had turned inward. I think a lot of those poll results are overstated, in part because it's really hard to capture a lot of the texture of what people think in a few poll questions. But I think more recent polling has shown that Americans both understand it's a complicated, difficult world out there, and America needs to show leadership. And indeed, I think if you look at campaign 2016, I realize it's only 2015, but the United States, we've already got started on campaign 2016. You hear a lot of candidates. There's certainly a lot of candidates on the Republican side of the aisle. I think the last I counted was 15. We're going to go to 17 before the end of the month. Four or five candidates on the Democratic side, all talking about the need to provide strong American leadership. But I think even there, it's not clear what that means at the end of the day, in part because a lot of the problems we have that haven't been resolved because of a lack of interest, or it's not because they haven't been noticed, but they're very difficult problems to crack. And I think that's sort of the great challenge for the United States, in part because from the vantage point of the United States, you hear calls for American leadership from across the globe. And obviously, if you try to be everywhere, you run the risk of being ineffective in lots and lots of places. And I think one of the challenges for this administration, it's clearly for the next one, going to be the question of what the priorities are in American foreign policy.
Let's go to some of those kind of crises and some of those hotspots. Let's start with the region that I know the best, the Middle East. It says something about the depths of the crisis in the region when a hugely controversial deal with Iran over its nuclear program is probably the brightest spot on the kind of the Middle East horizon at the moment. You know, when you talk to Gulf leaders, you know, before the deal, you know, their one great fear was that America would do nothing about Iran, but their second greatest fear was that America would do something about Iran. So, you know, you get that sense of, you know, the sense that the expectation of American leadership was higher than what America could ultimately deliver. What kind of marks do you give the Obama administration for its effort on the Iranian nuclear deal, leaving aside for the moment the question about how good the deal is?
Well, I used to be a college professor, which is a profession that I think has been defined as someone who talks while other people sleep. And I think I've been accused of that. So I've gotten out of the grading business. So I don't know what I would necessarily grade people or grade this administration. I think it is safe to say that the administration's had a number of misses, which I think have created problems for U.S. leadership. I think the most notable one was the about-face on Syria, which I have heard in travels around the world from people about the harm that was done to the United States there. Even if it's the case that a U.S. intervention in Syria might not have paid off. And again, that's always the problem. I think your opening of the question gets to the challenge we face. You know, they say, you regret it if you do, you'll be sorry if you don't. And I think there are a fair number of challenges out there on that score. I do think when we talk about the Iran deal, I'm not so sure people would say it's even the brightest news coming out of the Middle East. I think it's a great split over the merits of the deal. But you didn't ask me to tell you what the merits of the deal, so I'll stop.
We'll come to the merits of the deal.
I will pace the interview.
Yeah. I mean, the point I'm getting there is, one of the, say what you like about the deal, one of the interesting things about it is it's an example of sustained diplomacy over a period, and the kind of diplomacy we haven't seen from the US and the Middle East in a long time. It was often that reliance on the use of military force. I mean, surely that says something good about American leadership in the region and in the world.
Well, I'm sure if you were to ask Saudi officials or Israeli officials, you will not get a positive reaction to seeing the newfound American resumption in diplomacy. I should be fair to the people in the State Department, U.S. State Department, work very hard. There's a lot of negotiating going on. It's been going on for decades. I think this is probably the most visible, highest stakes negotiations that we have had for many a year. And I think it's safe to say that at the end of the day, the United States got less than it hoped to get out of the deal. That's not atypical for most negotiations. Like anyone who's been involved in a negotiation is, you may have what you aspire to get and what you need to get. And I think the debate in the United States now is going to be over whether we got what we needed to get in this deal.
And so let's come to the deal. I mean, you know, everyone's passing the deal. In many cases, passing it before they've even read it. You know, what's your take on it?
I would describe it as a decent, narrow deal, not a great or transformational deal. And I think in part, people are putting way too much on this particular deal in terms of what it is going to accomplish. And I think both in terms of the people who are criticizing it, saying that this is going to forfeit American leadership in the region and condemn us to Iranian hegemony in the Middle East, overstate. Likewise, for those people who support the deal and argue it's going to transform Iran's relationship with the West, I think they are engaging in not wishful thinking, but rather, to put it, premature thinking. I mean, it may be that the deal will lead down the road to profound changes, but those changes won't happen because of this deal. I'd make two other points about the deal. The second is the deal has to be evaluated in terms of what are your alternatives. And the alternatives aren't very good. And what I hear bandied about are sort of two alternatives. One is, well, we will just walk away from this deal and give instructions to American negotiators to go back and get a better deal. I think that is dangerous thinking, because I think for better or worse, the fact that this deal has now been signed changes the equation. And that what is going to happen is that if the United States walks away from this deal, the results won't be that we can sit back down with the Iranians and negotiate a deal in which the Iranians give up more. I think it will change perceptions among our negotiating allies that the United States has let a good enough deal go by. And I think what you'll have at the end of the day is the collapse of any deal whatsoever, and you will have the United States not acting in concert with the rest of the P5-1 plus one, but alone. I think you could end up with an Iran that has significant freedom on the nuclear front. Conversely, the other option people talk about is the use of military force. I've been to a lot of meetings in which people who are much more skilled and schooled on military issues argue that, okay, I am the source of that crackling. I apologize. But you know, the military option wasn't used because it has never been obvious that it would work in any long-term sense, and the cost could be potentially very, very high. In terms of bombing of nuclear facilities in Iran, the experts like to use the phrase mowing the lawn. That is, you wouldn't just bomb once, you would bomb periodically. And it's, at least for me, hard to imagine that the United States could sustain over the long term, a bombing campaign and keep its allies on board. I think that the final point I make about the deal is I think it matters less what was agreed in Vienna last week than what the United States does going forward. And there are sort of two challenges. One is to ensure that Iran complies with the deal. And we can, if you want, talk about the verification procedures. But while I think the verification procedures are reasonable, making sure that you actually get compliance is more than having procedures in place. It's making sure you have the willingness when confronted with information you don't want to have to act on it. But I think the opposite danger is also the case, maybe even greater one. My boss, Richard Haas, at the Council on Foreign Relations, is making this point a lot, is what if the Iranians actually comply with the deal? How are you going to deal with that? And I think for the United States to be successful in this, the policy of dealing with Iran, this particular has to be embedded in a broader strategy for dealing with Iran. That is, to the extent that you wish to challenge Iran on its treatment of human rights in terms of its behavior in the region, what is your strategy for maximizing change on that score? And I think that part of the equation that has been underdeveloped both by the administration and by critics of the administration.
Right. Before we leave the Middle East, and we've got a lot to get through today, I want to ask about Islamic State in Iraq. The Obama administration responded, you can say, reasonably well to the challenge that Islamic State proposed. They put together a military coalition. They worked with the Iraqis, possibly even with the Iranians, and they put in place a military strategy to contain Islamic State. It seems now that Islamic State has adapted to our strategy, but we haven't yet adapted to their adaptation. So where do you see that kind of going forward, and what do you think the administration has to do now? And are they being a little burdened by this fear of sending troops back into Iraq on the ground?
I'm not sure they're burdened by the fear of sending troops back in the ground as much as not persuaded that reinserting American combat troops are going to solve the problem. I personally don't believe they will. And they're also burdened by the fact that if you're going to have coalition warfare, and this is essentially what it is, it helps if your partners are actually willing to fight. And in this case, the challenge the administration faces is that the Iraqi army has not held up. They have, on too many occasions, fled the battlefield, despite an awful lot of American training, despite the revision of an awful lot of materiel to train and equip them for this. And I think the challenge the administration faces is if the Iraqis do not wish to fight for Iraq, it's not clear the United States can substitute for them. This then gets us into bigger questions about whether the United States needs to change its strategy and do more to work with the Kurds than we already have. And as you know much better than I do, Anthony, that raises a whole bunch of thorny questions about the nature of statehood and the sanctity of borders in the Middle East.
We could talk about the Middle East all day, but we should look at other parts of the world. Russia is the interesting kind of story, I suppose. When you talk to American military people privately, they'll tell you that even though they're focused on the fight against Islamic State, that the thing that really worries them in the world at the moment is Russia, and not just what's happened in Ukraine, but also the kind of more aggressive Russian kind of military moves. Do you think the administration has got that policy right yet? Is it something that's still evolving? What does the U.S. need to do to deal with this challenge?
It's a big challenge. I don't think the administration has it exactly right yet. It's not just up to the administration, but also our European powers. And I think that a lot of it's going to require reassurance to our allies. I'll just go back with the observation that General Joseph Dunford, he's the Obama administration's nominee to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was up at the Senate last week to give testimony for his nomination, and he was asked to talk about the threats, in his view, that face the United States, and his answer was he put Russia number one, followed by China and then North Korea. The discussion of the self-proclaimed Islamic State came after that. The challenge that Russia poses is military, but not only military. It's also diplomatic. It's military in the sense that we clearly have a new, more aggressive Russian policy. I know NATO commanders are very worried, as are most authorities throughout Europe, by the much more aggressive posture taken by Russian aircraft on their patrols and also Russian shipping, clearly designed, at a minimum, to remind everybody that Russia still has a military. Talk coming out of Moscow about the willingness to resort to nuclear weapons and the like to sort of intimidate the West. But I think there's also the worry about actions taken by the Russians to sow dissension within Europe. I was recently in the Baltics, and I think there's a great concern there about Russians trying to foment unrest and create divisions in the Baltics, but also elsewhere in Europe. I know the American administration, the Obama administration, is greatly concerned about Greece, both in terms of what it means for the global economy, but also for the potential that it might offer for the Russians to drive a wedge into Western Europe. When I was in Moscow last month, what I heard from a number of Russians is that for Mr. Putin, is very committed to his policy that if the extent Westerners think that he's sort of done in Ukraine, they're likely wrong. that for Mr. Putin, the ultimate victory would be able to drive a major wedge within Europe. But the reason he's able to do that is in part because Europe itself has some very significant problems. They are problems that may have their roots in the rather laggard economic recovery they have had from the recession, maybe be a stretch to say recovery, because certainly in Greece and a number of other countries in the southern Mediterranean, Europe has not recovered. But in that sense, that the Russians, in terms of trying to meddle or divide Europe, are doing so on fertile ground. And that kind of challenge is a very difficult one to sort of formulate a response to, particularly because it raises issues that the United States has no influence over. Because it touches on a lot of domestic politics in Europe. And as you can imagine, again, Europeans, like others, are great to have American leadership, except when it means that the United States is going to come in and tell them how to do things. So you're left in a role of trying to urge and cajole, but that doesn't always necessarily lead to the kind of outcomes you want.
And I want to stay there at the moment, because the challenge, as you point out, it's not just how you confront Russia, but how you encourage and work with your allies. Because you know, Europe has become more introspective. It's dealing with very serious economic problems. This is also giving rise to kind of political and social issues. Even you know the great American ally in Europe, the UK, there's a lot of concern, including by people that might be expected to express a bit of Schadenfreude, say the French, about Europe, the UK's role in the world. The Obama administration has talked a lot about allies needing to do more. How do you get Europe in the circumstances that it's in to do more, even on its own doorstep, let alone elsewhere in the world?
Well, I was say, if you have the answer to that, let me know, because I know that there are senior American officials who would like to know, because this has come up in the issue over Greece. I mean, I think the message that Washington has sent to Europe in terms of negotiations over Greece's debt problem is that Europe should not think of this as a narrow economic or fiscal or debt issue. It's a broader geopolitical issue. It's also tied up into very different visions of what Europe needs to do to get its economy growing again. The United States is, I think, the U.S. policy and policy vision of view of most economists is that Europe has gotten more austerity than it needs. It needs now to have pro-growth policies. But again, as you probably know, that's not how the problem is viewed from Europe, or particularly from Berlin. And Berlin has very clearly been able to drive this. And if you talk to American officials, they've given lots of advice to the Europeans, particularly the Germans. And I think on many scores, the Germans in particular aren't interested.
Or listening.
Well, again, they have their own domestic political challenges because obviously... in Germany, I mean, the German public feels very strongly that the policy that the EU or the Eurozone is applying toward Greece is exactly the policy that should be pursued.
Let's head east now. The part of the world that obviously concerns Australia and Australians most and Australian policymakers. We've been talking ad infinitum about how you deal with a rising China economically. We've been talking about it for years now, but the rubber's really starting to hit the road now with things like what we've seen in the South China Sea, where it's not just an academic question anymore. You've got to come up with some kind of concrete policy responses. You see that also in the people saying, well, we should do more, we should kind of push back on the Chinese, but then when you ask them, well, what will you do specifically, it suddenly gets very non-specific in terms of their answers. I mean, how is that debate being, where's that debate at in Washington at the moment in terms of how you respond to what China's doing?
I think the question there really is, who are you asking in Washington, D.C.? I think if you're in the think tank community or the professional foreign policy community, I would say that there's a lot more talk about the need to be tougher in dealing with the Chinese. People don't like to use the term red lines, but make it clear to the Chinese that there are behaviors that are considered undesirable and that there are costs to pursuing those behaviors. I think we've seen that particularly in dealing with cybersecurity and hacks. I think you're seeing it in terms of talking about Chinese activity in the South China Sea. And indeed, I think new Secretary of Defense Ash Carter at the Shangri-La Dialogue earlier this year, I think tried to make this clear to Chinese counterparts, but also people in the region. But again, you sort of put your finger on sort of the difficulty from the vantage point of Washington in doing this. You want to do it in such a way that you lead your friends and allies, but don't get too far out in front of them. And that's a very difficult dance to do because people, again, want leadership, but they also don't want a crisis. And trying to find that sort of, we call it Goldilocks solution, can be very, very difficult to do. I think more broadly, it's not at all clear that the American public or the American political debate is really focused on China right now. I mean, one of the interesting things, I mentioned this to you at lunch, we are going to have a presidential campaign, and part of what I do in my job is I write profiles of all the candidates who've entered. We're again at 15, and it's going to go to 17 by the end of the month. On the Republican side, we have 4 or 5 on the Democratic side. And I would say, overall, I'm generalizing here, the vast majority of them have never really spoken to what they think U.S. policies toward China should be. Now, that could change. It would change dramatically if we were having an incident, let's say, in the South China Sea. But I think right now, I'm not sure that we as a country on the whole have a real consensus on what a sensible policy toward China would be.
Does that mean that, you know, people talk about the pivot, the American pivot to Asia? It's a formal Obama policy. They debate whether it's actually happening, the military aspects, the economic aspects. I suppose the question is, even if America is pivoting to Asia militarily, even if it's pivoting to Asia economically, is it pivoting to Asia intellectually in the sense that it's now thinking about Asia as a problem? And I don't just mean the policy elites, I mean the general population. We could have answered it partly, but, you know, you don't. And what would it take, actually, to put China, Asia at the forefront of American thinking, both publicly but also, you know, in terms of foreign policy elites?
Well, I'm not sure you want Asia to be at the forefront of American foreign policy, because the way that would most likely happen is you have a crisis. I mean, there was a time when the United States had Asia foremost in its mind, if you go back to the late 60s and 1970s, particularly with Vietnam, but not only with Vietnam. Asia figured prominently in American foreign policy. So I'm not sure that I'm necessarily eager to get it back to the point where it's prominent with most Americans, because again, on most issues, Americans are focused on what's happening, affecting them directly at home, not worrying what's happening over across either the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean. And I think, but the bigger challenge, I think, in Washington right now is figuring out how is it that one deals with China. And I mentioned Secretary Carter's comments at the Shangri-La dialogue, but I would say more broadly, just from my vantage point, and this is all sort of anecdotal, if I were to go back a decade, I think most of the conversations we would have about China were recognizing that China was a new emerging power and that that would have substantial consequences for global politics. Nonetheless, very positive, very optimistic that China could be or would voluntarily choose to be become a stakeholder in this existing system. Now I think there's much more concern that China doesn't want to adapt or integrate into the system. It fundamentally wishes to remake that. And then, of course, that raises some very difficult questions about, A, is there anything you can do about that? If there is, what exactly is it? And how do you do it in such a way that you not only convince, let's say, the American public to endorse it, but you persuade the leaders and publics of other countries to endorse it? And I will note to my friends who I work with who work on Asia, they will note that it can be very hard even to get our allies to work with one another, let alone trying to get our allies to work with one another against China. And so it is a very, very big challenge to have to deal with. And I think almost everybody begins with the assumption that you want to find a way to coexist peacefully with China. I don't think that there is an incipient rise of people wanting confrontation with China. But I do think it's a real question about what is the best strategy for dealing with China so you minimize the chances of a confrontation.
I want to take some questions from the floor in a moment, but I wanted, before we do that, to talk a little about leadership, literally, the U.S. presidential campaign, which, as you said, has got off to a very early start. On the one hand, we see, you know, it looks like it's going to be Hillary for the Democrats. On the other side, it seems like everybody is running for president on the Republican side. And Donald Trump is leading.
Yes.
Take us through where the campaign is at the moment.
Oh, it has so much further to go, for well or for ill. What I would say right now is, again, you're right. I think on the Democratic side, conventional wisdom is that Secretary Clinton is a prohibitive favorite to win the nomination. On the Republican side, it is up for grabs given the number of candidates you have. And I think we're now starting to move into the serious phase. We're going to have our first real campaign event, as these things go in the United States, in the month of August, in which we're going to have the first Republican nomination, and that's already a source of great consternation among Republicans because it's very hard to fit 17 candidates on a debate stage. So they're now
especially if one of them is Donald Trump, right?
Well, we'll get to that in a second. But so they're going to winnow it down now to 10, and there's a great deal of consternation over what the rules are to get it down to 10, because people are noting that if you go strictly on the basis of national polls, and that's the main, as best I can tell, criterion so far, you're going to have a couple of fairly successful large state governors. Think John Kasich of Ohio, which is going to be a pivotal state in the election in 2016, not even getting up on the stage. So it's a real question about that. And, of course, the wild card in all of this is having Mr. Trump on the campaign scale because I think it is safe to say he follows a very different set of rules when it comes to engaging with his Republican rivals. He has benefited nationally from the fact that he's a celebrity. Was a celebrity before the campaign began. He's able to self-finance, and he knows how to draw media attention. And if there's one thing Mr. Trump is very good at, it's that. And so in many ways, he is dominating the conversation. And the interesting thing for Republican challengers is to figure out some way to deal with that. And I think you've sort of seen varying strategies for Republican candidates how to deal with him. And the wild card is going to be if he gets up on a debate stage, how that is going to go. Mm-hmm. Or conversely, if he's not invited, how that all shakes out. And your guess is the answer to that is as good as mine.
What explains his early popularity? Is it just what you've mentioned, the celebrity, the profile, he's known? Or is there something else there that tells us something about the mood of American people?
I think there are two things. One, don't underestimate being a celebrity. I mean, the fact is he is a known commodity. And so part of the thing is when people are asked opinion poll questions about issues that maybe not really have deep-seated opinions about, it's easy enough to offer up somebody that you've heard of as opposed to a small state governor who hasn't sort of really broken into the national news. But I think the other thing is that he is, in his way, sort of tapping into a deep-seated anger that exists among many, I guess we in the United States would call them Tea Party conservatives. These are people who, I think the fundamental question is, who's taken my country? I think you can see this in a lot of public opinion polling and certainly a lot of conversations. It's a feeling that Washington doesn't work for them, that their country's being fundamentally changed, that government elites are corrupt, and they need somebody to shake the place up. Now, this is really, in many ways, just a variation on a long-standing thing in American politics, which is everybody runs against Washington. Everybody vows to go to Washington to change things. But this is a much more extreme version of this. And I think also on the left, different sort of dynamic, but similar in a way, in which people again feel that, in this case, big corporations, big interests are sort of benefiting from the system and that they're losing out. And this gets back again to the question of to what extent the American economy is working for everyone. And I think you would note, I think it's been fairly well commented on. Inequality in the United States is way up. It is at levels we haven't seen since before the Great Depression. Also, you're seeing very dramatic changes in wage structure. Real wages for most Americans have stagnated over the last 30 years. And sort of globalization, which in many ways is an American invention. We argued that if the rest of the world joined us in having open capitalist economics, people would benefit, and that's been the case. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of people lifted out of poverty in places like India and China. But one of the consequences is put much pressure on the basic American economic structure, and a lot of people have been losers of that, and they, I think, are angry. It's tied up also with issues of immigration. I think an issue that I think many Australians can identify with. And so I think there's a lot of anger out there in the public. And I would actually broaden. I don't think this set of issues is limited to the United States alone. Again, going back to Europe, I think in Europe there's the same sense of people feeling the system is not working for them and thinking that sort of the social contract with the government is either fraying or broken and that government is not able to deliver what it is they expected the government to deliver to them. And that, I think, creates some toxic politics.
We'll take some questions from the floor now. Raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and let us know who you are.
Thanks very much. Richard Bronowski, President of Australian International Affairs in New South Wales. Anthony, first, may I say a good article of yours, balanced on Iran, I think, in the Australian. And to you, Professor, what chances are there that this hard-won deal, which I think is very good, it's cut back on fissionable material, it's delayed the possibility of Iran going to the nuclear weapons by at least 10 years. It's the best that could be done because we passed up the opportunity when Khatami was president because George W. Bush called him part of the axis of evil. Mm-hmm. That's an opportunity missed. But can this be derailed by the Tea Party? I imagine if Hillary Clinton gets to be president, it won't be. She won't want it to be. But can Obama survive long enough to overrule them and say, no, this is going through and let's get it ratified? What are the chances of this happening?
Okay. I would say the odds that President Obama is able to sustain his policy while he is president are high. After he's president, all bets are off. Okay, let me just sort of explain that, because it requires a little bit of understanding of sort of the complex system that we've constructed for this. By virtue of a law that the U.S. Congress passed earlier this year, this deal now has to go before Congress, and Congress has to be given an opportunity to, if it chooses to, vote a resolution of disapproval. And I believe that the agreement was submitted yesterday. So that would mean Congress has 60 days from yesterday to vote. So we're talking September 20th or so. And the convention of wisdom goes as follows. The resolution of disapproval will be introduced. Both houses of Congress will vote for the resolution of disapproval. The bill will go to the president. He will veto it. And then the question will be, can the president sustain his veto? Now, in the U.S. system, what that essentially boils down to is can the president hold 34 members of his own party in the Senate? If he does, he can sustain his veto. Now, that's a pretty high bar. Just to put it in perspective, Congress has not overridden a presidential veto in foreign policy since 1985, so 30 years. Okay? So odds are good. The problem for the president, however, is that the political incentives for many people who might be undecided or hostile to the deal are to vote against it. In part because I think most Americans are not engaged in the deal at all, which is not atypical, and that the people who have an opinion tend to be people who are very, very deeply opposed to it. And they would, I think, acknowledge your point that it provides us 10 to 15 years of respite from an Iranian nuclear program. Their question is, what happens after 10 to 15 years? And I think that's one of the big questions. And again, it gets back to what can you reasonably expect a deal like this to provide? And critics have argued that it should have shut down an Iranian nuclear program essentially into perpetuity, which clearly I think the Iranians were never going to be willing to do. The second part of your question, though, is what happens, assume the convention of wisdom is correct, a resolution of disapproval either doesn't pass or if it does pass gets vetoed, then the question becomes what would the next president do? And I think the chances are the next president would probably have to find some way to live with the agreement, in part because of the cost of walking it back because the allies are all on board. And I should note there's a revision in the agreement for so-called snapback sanctions. They don't bring all the sanctions back. They bring some sanctions back. And I won't get into the mechanics of it, but it was cleverly set up so that any one of the P5 plus one can snap the sanctions back. And so I could imagine a next president not walking away from the deal, but using that snapback provision to reimpose the UN sanctions. A lot of the U.S. sanctions aren't going to come off anytime soon because it requires an act of Congress. But I will say that there are some Republican candidates who have said categorically that if they become president, the first thing they will do is, in essence, toss that executive agreement out. There are a couple of them. I think Jeb Bush is here. I think Chris Christie, governor of Jersey, who both said, I'll decide what to do when I get into office because the whole situation can be different. I would expect that this deal is going to be very much a part of the American political conversation this fall and into the spring as the primaries really heat up.
Ewan Graham with the Institute. Jim, welcome to Sydney.
Thank you.
Thank you for the sweep that you gave us. There are two contending narratives of the final part of the administration on foreign policy. One is that this is the tail end, the A team have left, the B team are on the way out, and it's basically hold the line at best. On the other hand, I keep going back to the president's comments earlier this year that interesting things happen in the fourth quarter. And in terms of elective foreign policy initiatives, Cuba is one obvious one. Iran, I think, is a second. I'd like to get your thoughts on whether you think there's anything left in the locker for a third foreign policy initiative. And with that thought, to bring you back to Asia, that the administration has actually, against that first narrative, recently firmed up its Asia team with a couple of recent appointments, Abe Denmark at DOD, Eli Retner in state. So does that point, in fact, to a possibility that there may be a third Asian initiative?
Well, I would say, first of all, I vowed when I came up here I was not going to use any American sports metaphor or analogies to make a point. And you just drew one from American football, which is very different
from he's British as well.
I know, from Australian rules football. So I'm not going to indulge in sports metaphors, as tempting as it is. What I would say is that I'm from the camp that believes that presidents like to be president up until noon on the final day that they're in office. And it seems to me a trope in American politics. Everybody always says that the people who are on hand at the end of administration, you know, aren't the ones who start up. But that's natural because those jobs are really hard. Very few people can do them for 4 or 8 years and live to tell the tale. But I would say specifically about whether there's a third initiative. I think the initiative's already underway, and that is Trade Promotion Authority. Trans-Pacific Partnership, a little jet lagged here. The president got Congress to give him trade promotion authority earlier this summer. It went through a near-death experience. It was one of the most unusual legislative journeys to becoming a bill than I can recall, and I am by training someone who studies what Congress does in foreign policy. But the president now has that authority. Trade negotiators are convening starting on Friday at the Westin Resort in Maui, which makes me realize in my next life I should come back as a trade negotiator.
That sounds like going to be a long negotiation.
Yes, yeah. I think obviously that may be the reason why some of these talks get dragged out. But I think there's a lot of optimism that a deal will get done, maybe not at the end of the month, but in the weeks to follow. There are a lot of very difficult issues to settle, but I know your trade minister is fairly optimistic that a deal can get done. And then the question, of course, is can Mr. Obama get that deal through the United States Congress? And here's where things get very connected. Number one, the president has to, I think, have triumphed on the Iran deal. I mean, if it turns out the conventional wisdom is wrong and Congress overrules the president, I think it would weaken him considerably and make it much harder to get a trade deal through, assuming one gets done. I think also this fall is going to be very, very difficult one in Washington because our fiscal year runs from October 1 to September 30th. And by September 30th, Congress is supposed to wrap up all of the appropriation bills because the way the U.S. runs its government, we have to make funding decisions every year. And we are now on, I guess what today is, July 22nd. The vast bulk 21st. Of those 21st. The vast bulk of those appropriation bills have not been enacted. And moreover, we have something called the debt ceiling, which was for a while suspended. It went back into effect, I think, in March. That limits what the U.S. government can borrow because we're running a deficit. The U.S. Treasury has lots of ways to get around that limit for a while, so-called extraordinary measures. Everybody guesses that those extraordinary measures are going to run out sometime this fall. So a lot of the air in Washington could be consumed by trying to avoid a government shutdown. Nobody seems to want one. However, I will note that nobody really wanted the previous government shutdowns. Most people didn't want the previous government shutdowns, and they happened. So the legislative calendar is going to be very, very heavy into the fall. So, and given the protocols put down in Trade Promotion Authority, that bill won't get voted on probably till the end of the year, most likely not until 2016. And then there's always the risk it gets caught up in campaign politics, which is always a wild card. I think the odds are good that the president will be able to get Trans-Pacific Partnership, if it is signed, into law, but I would not underestimate how difficult it will be, and I think that will take up a lot of their energy between now and early next spring. And if the president has another initiative up his sleeve, good luck with it. He's showing remarkable fortitude and determination, because he's got a lot on his plate right now.
Good afternoon. My name's Stephen Blanks. I'm in sales and marketing and just a novice in foreign policy. No, by no means an expert. One thing that does interest me, though, like obviously with the Roman Empire, whenever it expanded or, you know, took over new countries, one of the key things is they had to pay for it. And I'm just wondering with yourself with foreign policy, when you do decide which direction you're going to take, is obviously the deciding how you're going to fund it and pay for it. Is that one of the key considerations on what tack you do take?
I would say no. And I would say historically in the United States, certainly since the United States became a global power after World War II, and certainly I think by the mid-1960s, not a lot of attention was paid to matching up sort of costs with resources, which is one of the reasons why the United States managed to acquire fairly sizable national debt. That has been an issue in U.S. politics since about 2010, where the so-called Tea Party came to the fore. Concern about debt and deficits has really receded in the United States in recent months. And you then get into questions of to what extent is America's deficit spending sustainable. I won't bore you with all the details. Probably in the short run, it is sustainable. The big question is when you go out, let's say, more than 10 to 15 years, when various commitments on the entitlement front begin to bite. But one has to weigh that against the fact that the U.S. economy is actually doing quite well and has a lot of very sort of powerful tailwinds. Just to give you some perspective, Europe, 5 years after the bottom of the Great Recession, overall GDP, I believe, is still below where it was in 2009, 2010. U.S. is about 8 to 9 percentage points above it. The United States, I think, is benefiting immensely from the energy revolution, particularly the rise of fracking. The United States is soon going to be the world's largest producer of oil and natural gas, so much so that one of the big issues in the United States is, should we allow the export of both? The United States has banned it for quite some time. So I think the economic fundamentals are very good, but you put your finger on something that's quite correct. Even if your economic fundamentals are good, if you have bad policies, you're going to run into a pinch. I think the United States can solve its financial difficulties and square it with global leadership, but the fact that something is doable doesn't mean it will happen.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for a wonderful tour d'horizon. Can I ask you a question following on from Ewan? And can I ask you for an early historical assessment of the Obama presidency? He came to office with very, very high expectations. It seems it really is only months ago that everybody was writing Obama off. We were in that the seven-year itch where we get completely sick of presidents and they're the biggest failure ever. But he has really rallied as an historical figure in the last month or two, with Obamacare being endorsed by or being judged constitutional by the Supreme Court, with gay marriage, with several big initiatives, most importantly the Iran one. It seems to me that he, whatever we think about him, whether we like him or not, he's now going to have to be considered an historically important president. Do you agree with that? And I know that it'll take a long time to come up with proper definitive judgments, but what's your sense now in the final quarter of how history will view his presidency?
My honest guess is that historians and analysts will argue for years to come about how consequential his presidency would be. I only say that because I'm a big fan of American history and I've read biographies of all the American presidents, and I can find biographies of every president that says they were the best thing since sliced bread to they were the worst. So I think Americans have a tendency to historically look back at their presidents and judge them in terms of their problems in that day as to whether they think that president sort of speaks to them. So I think that will always be changing. I think that in many ways the president's things he does that are consequential or how consequential he is going to depend upon probably three things. One, what is the long-term success of Obamacare? Okay, this is, you're quite right that it survived a bunch of legal challenges, but ultimately its success is going to be judged on whether it helps deal with the long-term problems of funding and insuring American citizens. And I think it's too early to declare that a success. It's overcome some very early mistakes, some of which were self-inflicted, but I think there's a long way to go on that. I think the second thing is really going to be a consequence of this Iran deal over the long term. And again, part of the challenge for the president, he's not going to be around for at least the final 8 years of the 10-year period referred to before. And again, my view is that the most important work on Iran is yet to come. This is all in many ways preliminary, what we've done so far. I think that the third challenge for the president, and this is the harder deal, is did the president get the Middle East right? And I don't think, I have my own views, but I don't think the answer to that is obvious. It's clearly divisions in the United States. Again, much of the American public wanted to come home from Iraq and Afghanistan. We largely left Iraq, and the results haven't been good. But as I noted earlier, there's a lot of reason to argue that it wouldn't be much better if we had stayed. It would have been a different set of problems. And again, I think sort of how the Middle East goes is going to, at least in terms of the foreign policy side of assessing the president's legacy, going to be significant. I'll also just sort of step back and say, I do think, you know, just thinking over the last now, I guess, more than 6 years, I think the president disappointed a lot of people, certainly disappointed a lot of his followers in terms of what he wasn't able to achieve in foreign policy. I think he may have disappointed himself again. Now, but I would, I'm a pretty soft touch when it comes to grading on that score. What I will note is that the expectations going into his presidency, I think, were far higher than any president could ever deliver on. The best piece of advice I ever got in my work career is to underpromise and overdeliver. So I've always worked at underpromising. I'm not always successful at overdelivering, but I can give you an underpromise. I think for the president, though, the expectation was, I mean, think of it. He was going to solve the problems in the Middle East. It was not going to be an issue for Americans again. He was going to deal with the threat of nuclear war. He had his famous Prague speech, helped him win the Nobel Peace Prize. And those very ambitious goals haven't been achieved. And I don't think realistically looking back on it that anyone could have expected him to achieve it. I think finally he has not been able to bring together the American public or the American foreign policy elite on a consensus about how to act. And again, I can certainly point to things along the way he did that I think probably didn't help that. But I think it really want to say it takes two to tango. That's not a sports metaphor. But I do think that there's a bigger fissure there than expect any president to be able to resolve. And I think the next president is going to have to deal with it. We are a country which on many issues, there is no consensus on what the right thing is to do. And again, there's an upside to that, which we tend to get consensus in the United States when we're under threat. So the fact that we don't have a consensus to some extent is projecting the fact that right, at least right now, we're not threatened or sufficiently threatened, and that might be a good thing. Not a pleasant thing, but it could be not a terribly bad thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know there are a few more questions out there, but I'm sorry, we've run out of time. Jim, I don't know if you whether you under-promised, but you certainly over-delivered today.
That's very kind of you.
Thank you very much for that really wide-ranging tour of America's role in the world. Please join me in thanking Jim Reason. And we'll see you all next time.